Conversations on Woman of Size often have adult themes and language, so if you're listening in mixed company, beware, earmuffs may be needed. What's up, everybody? Hey, what's up? Thank you so much for listening to Woman of Size. I'm your host, Jana Schmieding. It's announcement week. We're going into the autumnal season, which is personally my favorite time of year weather-wise, but also is a very sticky pumpkin spice hot mess for Native people in this country. Just to give you a bit of an overview, October means Columbus Day, where people celebrate a sociopath. And it also sometimes, not as much lately, thank God, but I don't know. Depends on where you are. It means racist costumes at Halloween. November is Native American Heritage Month, and I expect I'll be asked to be in a lot of comedy shows for the first time ever this month, this November. Also, Native American Heritage Month is where Native people just get asked to perform a shit ton of free labor. We also have Thanksgiving, which is a triggering holiday for Native people and fat folks alike. So I'll be bailing out of that weird event, as I usually do. Anyway, I ask you, non-Native listeners, to use this lovely time of year to support Native creatives. If you want to support me, I have a Patreon now for Woman of Size, which means you can throw a dollar or more at me every month as a sign that you're enjoying my podcast and benefiting from my work. A reminder that I do not get paid to make this podcast. I do it out of love for my communities, and I want to continue to do it. Even as I slip into total poverty, baby. Help a bitch out. Also, last week, the book The Other F Word was released, and I'm a contributor to the book. The Other F Word is a collection of essays from fat writers that many of us follow. It's for YA audience, but I think it's also a really lovely read for adults. My essay is called Chubby City Indian, and I talk about my experiences growing up in a white community and a Native community, and how bodies were viewed differently through those two lenses. I want you to buy this book! Support fat writers, give the book to your kids, your nieces, your nephews, your grandkids, or keep it in your own library, because let's be honest, we need literature that validates our damn experiences. Okay. Speaking of writers, I'm so excited about today's guest. She's a Lakota humorist and poet and has a book called Bury My Heart at Chuck E. Cheese's being released this week. Oh my gosh, please buy it. Review it with high praise. I cannot wait to read it. Enjoy my conversation with Standing Rock Sioux writer Tiffany Midge. Okay, everyone, I am here on the phone with Tiffany Midge. She is an author, a poet, a humorist, writer, and an advocate / activist, an Indigenous woman. Hi, Tiffany.
Hi.
Oh my gosh, I'm so happy to have you and to finally talk to you. We follow each other on the socials, but like it's one of those relationships where you just you think you're going to go through time and just only be social media people. And now we're actually having a talk.
We are. It's very exciting. I've been following you for a very long time as well.
It's super so cool. Exciting.
I was very happy when you like contacted me about your program and I just was very, very ecstatic.
Yeah. Tiffany, I'm going to talk to you about a bunch of things on this episode. And want to get into your career, everything about your life. I mean, I really want to just know everything.
My brilliant career. My glamorous and brilliant career.
I'm sure it's glamorous and brilliant, oh, and I so can't wait to find out all about it.
Oh my God.
But first, because this is a podcast about our bodies and lives, I would love to know what language you use to describe and discuss your body, and how do you identify including your tribal affiliation?
Oh, the tribal affiliation would be a citizen of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. And insofar as identification as body type, I identify as as husky.
Ooh, husky is a great one.
It is. I don't think that it's used often enough.
I don't either. I might start employing it. Let's bring it back. Husky.
Yeah. you know, and you have to understand, too, that, you know, not that I am of a different generation. So it's really interesting being, you know, in my 50s, in my early 50s. And
yeah,
being able to see, like, the world just changing.
Yeah, what do you see, especially in terms of body identification?
Well, everyone, I'm on a learning curve when it comes to a lot of language and terms and how people are identifying. And there's names and terms for absolutely everything now.
Sure, you know? Are.
And it's really amazing, but it does require a lot of mental bandwidth.
It does, yeah.
And things like fat activism and the promotion of fat acceptance are definitely among these ways of being in the world and for living within our society today. That kind of language and terms, those weren't accessible or even invented, you know, when I was coming of age.
Yeah, it must be just so. What does it feel like? Does it feel like you've been you've been like occupied or that you've been like corrected or that you like have done it wrong? Or what does it feel like to be a person that's like, wait, no, now we actually love our bodies?
Oh my gosh.
I mean, I have a taste of it too. I'm no spring chicken. But, like, I was raised to hate that body, girl. Correct it all the time.
Yeah. No, it's definitely a different way of seeing and viewing things. Yeah. And it's a constant negotiation, I think, because I vacillate, you know, back and forth all the time. You know, like, I have to constantly, yeah, like, you know, kick myself up the head every so often, you know, when, like old modes of thinking sort of erupt. And then I have to go, oh, well, we're not thinking like that anymore. So here I am, you know.
Is it liberating or is it?
It's liberating, and it's also, you know, can be difficult at the same time. Because, like I said, it's like I'm just going back and forth between, you know, the different modes of thinking and the different attitudes. So, yeah, it's like two people living in the same body. I have like this young person and then this old person.
Totally.
Yeah, so, but.
Interesting. So you are Standing Rock tribal citizen. I feel like we're probably cousins.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Hey.
Yeah. Do you cousin? Where did you grow up, and what's kind of like your association with the tribe, the people, family, kinship, all that?
Well, I grew up in a region of, I mean, it was very diverse. Geographically, it was full of splendor. It was an area in Washington State called Snoqualmie, which is like the Indian word for beautiful mountain colonized by assholes.
That's actually a good one.
Yeah. It's a small Pacific Northwest town in the Cascade Foothills. My father taught middle school, and my dad was a white guy, and my mom was Lakota. And they met in Montana, and they came out to Washington State. My father did, you know, work at Boeing, and they had all these like little odd jobs. And then my father got a teaching job. And so it was a really actually very beautiful place when I was very young. It was just full of like dairy cows and forests and all kinds of really weird hippies. I mean, so I just ran around the town and just ran in the woods and the rivers and the streams. It's just a really young kid. So it was a really cool place to grow up. But that was before we moved to the suburbs.
The burbs, baby.
Yeah. So my mom was raised on Fort Peck, Indian Reservation in eastern Montana. But she was born over at Standing Rock in Bullhead, South Dakota, in a little cabin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and taken from her mother and, you know, went to go live with other relatives because it was shameful to bring up children out of wedlock in those days.
Ooh.
Yeah, so she was raised, and my grandma was a nurse, and she went to nursing school. Anyway, so she was raised up in eastern Montana, and then of course my dad was from Havre, Montana. So I have a really strong connection to Montana.
Yeah.
And
that's cool.
Yeah. So basically, I just knocked around the Northwest in the Seattle area. Mm-hmm. I lived in Bellingham. And I went to school in Bellingham before I moved here to Moscow to go to my MFA program. I moved here in 2005, and I've been here ever since.
Nice.
Oh my god. I know, it's really strange. Like, and you know, and I miss the Pacific Northwest all the time, but at the same time, I don't, because there's all sorts of complications about living in the city that there aren't any close complications at all when you live in a small rural area. You know, surrounded by farmland. The Seattle area is definitely different than growing up in some small rural area in eastern Oregon. But, you know, it just depends on the communities that are within that, you know, that city or that region. Mm-hmm. I grew up with a lot of Indian people because there was a lot of Indian people in you know, Seattle area. Mm-hmm, and we had special programs in the schools. That were like separate from, they were like extracurricular for like all the
Indians. You had like a title programs?
Exactly. And it was about the coolest thing ever, I think. Run by the most amazing woman ever. And so that had a lot of, you know, and then of course just my family. I had my family around me and they were all Indians. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I had family outside of the area, like in Montana and South Dakota and North Dakota. So, you know, my mom, she, you know, took me to powwows, and I was just always, you know, had that exposure, you know, to the culture, because of course my mom, you know, she brought a lot of that to us, to my sister and I, and
that's cool.
It's a very different, you know, it's kind of different, but it's not at the same time. But a lot of people that differentiation between, you know, urban and res, right? But it's interesting, you know, now people are talking about urban Indians, and books are being published about urban Indians.
Yeah, so. Very interesting. I just started reading They're There by Tommy Orange.
Oh, cool.
And I'm learning a lot about Oakland Indians.
Oh, yeah, intense.
So, yeah.
So that was, you know, that's probably very similar to what it's like in the Seattle area as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. Mm-hmm. And then you started writing. When did you begin writing, and specifically humor? How did that fall in line?
Well, I kind of grew up in a funny household. My mom was hysterical and my grandmothers were hysterical.
Oh my gosh. Can I please just really quickly tell you that I've talked about this on last season, but I have this, I want to bring this workshop to like, I want to, I have this workshop that I've written and created, and it's called Native Women Laughing. And it's literally just going to like women's groups, Native women's groups, or like conferences, and pulling out Native women and making a podcast that is just Native women sitting around telling jokes and writing and telling funny stories to each other and laughing at them.
Oh, that would be really cool.
Wouldn't it be fun? Native women are so fucking funny.
Pretty much.
I can't think of one that really isn't.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I'm like right on the same page with you there for sure.
So you're just around funny people cracking jokes all the time.
Yeah, just being silly, you know. And that was just entertainment, you know. But just being really irreverent and a little bit dark.
Inappropriate, you know. Yep. Very blue. We are a blue people.
Really bizarre stuff. I mean, I remember on the day of like one of my grandfather's funeral, my sister and my mother and I don't know why we would even do this, but you know, it's my grandpa's white, and so all of the funeral attendees were white, and they're having this reception in my grandmother and grandfather's house. And my sister and my mom and I mean, we must have been, I don't know, we were sitting on the porch laughing hysterically. And, you know, because it's one of those things where there's tension, and so you, like, you don't want to laugh in church, but you just can't hold it in. Yes. And it just becomes even funnier. And
those people must have thought we were
absolutely insane. All these, like, white Methodists.
Just totally. Oh my God.
Indian women on the porch just like hysterics.
I have a similar story. When my great grandmother, my grandma's grandma, passed away, I don't know if this is true in your family, but we take care of our sick and dying in the home in my family. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother was taking care of her mother when she was ill from cancer, I believe. And anyway, this was just such a, like, this moment stands out in my mind so much. I need to like write something about it. But I remember she died in the morning at some point, and the whole family was there. We had all like gathered to say goodbye, and I was like 5 or 6 years old. I was young. And I remember hearing in the front bedroom where she was sleeping and where she had passed, I remember hearing a bunch of laughing people. And I went into the bedroom, I like opened the door, and I see my naked great grandmother, my naked and dead great grandmother's body, and all of the women in the family are washing her body. And they're in hysterics.
Oh, wow.
I know.
Oh my God.
I was so taken aback. I was like, what's going on? Why are they laughing? But I was like, I mean, that laughter is medicine. Laughter is medicine. Like, being an adult now and having gone through the passing of several relatives, I understand. I get it.
Yeah. I mean, that basically happened at my mom's funeral, too.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. just having a good laugh.
To your grandma.
Totally. I mean, I think they were also like probably crying too, like laughing and crying at the same time, just like all the emotions. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. But at the same time, there must have been something that was just really funny.
I know. I don't know what it is. I'm not too afraid to ask.
Oh, that's really great. I love that.
Yeah. So how did you end up taking that comedy to the written form?
Well, I was always involved with community theater and musical theater. And it just seemed like poetry and writing was just a very natural extension of those kinds of activities. And along the ways, you know, I had teachers that inspired me a lot, and I had wonderful creative mentors and friends, and my family was always behind me. My sister bought me my first electric typewriter. That was really huge. That was like, you know, pre-personal computer.
Totally.
Like, ooh.
An electric. Wow, I can actually do something now.
I just made me feel like, oh, wow, I've arrived. I'm such a writer now. And I just sit at the kitchen table and like drink wine and smoke cigarettes.
I still want that life. I have that vision in my head all the time.
It was the best. It was the best when I was in my 20s. And when I started working a regular job, like a real job at King County, my boss said that she hired me because I was a poet and I loved literature, and she was actually really supportive and encouraging and steered me along quite a bit because she had a real love of writing and literature herself. And this was all happening in Seattle, and I used to have a collective of Native writers in the Seattle area, and we used to get together pretty frequently, and we organized conferences and events.
Wow.
So, I mean, these are sort of like formative years, you know, like in my 20s when I was still just trying to feel my way around.
Would you say that having a collaborative of Native people and that were also writers was like crucial / fundamental to your taking this to the next level? Or how did that community?
I think that's true of anybody. I think that, you know, a community is just really important. Is to be able to have like a group of people that, you know, that sort of, I don't know, it's not necessarily collaborative, but it's just provides, you know, not a platform, but like an anchor of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
Like writers belong to all these different schools. Like the school of writing or, you know, or people, that's why people go into their MFA programs for the most part. You know, if they're young and starting out, you know, they go to the MFA programs to like be a part of that and to be able to have that community to, you know, to stand on and to be supported by. And, you know, that's part of that. The reason why. But I, you know, I had the Raven Chronicles, which is a literary arts magazine in the Seattle area, and they were amazing, and they're a huge support to Native writers and artists and people of color in the Pacific Northwest.
I've never heard of that.
Oh, yeah.
What's
it
called?
They've been around for a really long time.
I should know.
And I made friends with a lot of the publishers and the editors, and I went to a lot of open mics.
Nice.
And just began, you know, sort of jumping off that way. So the Seattle
awesome.
Area, that's just sort of, you know, how it all began. But it's like glamorous life.
It's amazing. I mean, it's artistic, it's creative. I just really stan people who I love humans who choose a creative path. I think it's brave, and I think it's fucking hard, and it's also like weirdly fulfilling, even though it's such a trudge sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can be really scary. I mean, I remember the very first time that I ever read it at open mic, my knees were just like literally knocking together. It's so bizarre.
Yeah,
and it's so weird because I had been performing like practically my whole life, doing community theater and all of that, and plays and everything, so like to get up in front of a mic, why would I be so intimidated?
It's probably be so because in a mic you're telling your own stories and you're speaking from your own experience versus regurgitating Shakespeare's sonnets, or you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like there, it's a different element when you start to, and I think performers even come to that as well, where it's like, okay, I've mastered the art of theater or whatever. I'm like a great actor. I've had great training. And then it's all of a sudden like, what am I on this earth to talk about? Like, what's my story and how can I turn that into a performance? And then it's like, fuck.
Yeah.
So scary.
No, I hear ya. Yeah, definitely a different kind of thing, but I seem to have gotten over. Well, I mean, I got over the knee knocking, but I'm still really nervous.
Totally. So, me too.
But plays, you know, I'm not gonna mind. I might be a little bit nervous, but it just seems a lot easier to play a persona.
Awesome. And what was the first published, your first piece of published work?
Well, I was really excited about my community college literary magazine publication.
Nice. That is cool. I'd be excited too.
I was just ecstatic. And then, you know, the Raven Chronicles was my big debut.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, they published like 4 of my poems, and I thought I had arrived. They were really good poems, though. I love those poems still to this day.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. All right, we're going to just take a really quick break. Oh my gosh, did you know that Woman of Size has a live show? I know! Every 2 months, Jana hosts a live comedy show that clowns on sizeism and amplifies some of LA's biggest and funniest broads. You can find out when the next live show is at womanofsize.com/live show. Also, follow at Woman of Size Pod on Instagram and Twitter, where Jana makes sure you know where to find the funny. Come out and support Women in Comedy Los Angeles. I have this on my list of things, but I would love to hear one of your poems. If you have a favorite or one that you think is delightful or relevant, I don't know. Whatever thing you choose, would you be willing to read us or tell us a poem?
I'm totally psyched to do that. Yes.
Yes, do
yes,
it.
Please. I will read Savage Gazelle or Gazelle or Gazelle Gazelle. How do you say Gazelle?
Gazelle?
Gazelle. It's like a literary form. Yeah, we're off to a great start.
So far, so good. I don't even know what that word means.
it's a poetic form. Anyway, yeah. So
cool. Okay.
That's why you'll notice the repetitive word, and that's
great.
Part of the form. It's not me being boring. So this is a commentary on romance bodice rippers that are Native American and inspired.
Yes.
Okay. Savage Gazelle. Wigwam rhetoric. Hiawatha speak. Gitche Gumee. Savage this. Savage that. Gag me with acoustic. Savage literature for masses. Unbelievable. Barbie doll in buckskin. A scarlet-haired, green-eyed Pocaho. Savage straight from a land, a lake, butterbox. Call her fake, like tomahawk tassels, savage burlesque show in Minneapolis, that girl who fell in love with Kitsch, like the Savage series romances sold worldwide, dances with Shamil, dances with Shemazel. Synopses are neat. Start with Savage spirit, Kickapoo, chief fire thunder. For real, rescues his kidnapped sister from the circus sideshow. Savage heat, Zoe Hawkins lust after Kiowa Braves white shadow. All taboo, of course. What's passion if not forbidden, if not savage? Another, Morning Hawk, crazy in love for a mohawk should kill for. Naturally, an Indian maiden will cut a bitch. Savage-hearted they are, especially Apaches. They trill at the sight of blood. Take the Southwestern saga, Savage Arrow. High Hawk and Rising Moon both love a white girl with flame-red hair. Always with the gingers. Savage-hearted as Indians on the prairie and almost as criminal. Take Yvonne, whose lust ignited by silver arrow in savage passion, dark storms and treachery, a virile stranger sets blood of fire trembling like a fawn. In Savage Torment, our heroine in heat sets out to steal the heart of fierce, strong hawk, a forest savage in the Michigan woodlands. Her daddy owns the mill. They're star-crossed but doomed. Rinse and repeat. Savage rhymes with new age, and that's another kind of swill, another bitter pill to swallow. Savage stomach indigestion. Guilty pleasures appeal, sure, but in the final analysis, its lures all atrocity, all savage.
Yay! That was awesome. Oh my god. Mm-hmm. So most of your writing, first of all, that is so funny.
Thank you.
Funny, poignant, hard hitting. That's my review. Is most of your writing kind of clowning on the colonist gaze?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so wise.
That's kind of it.
That's like the smartest thing. I'm trying really hard to get my writing to that point. Uh-huh. And it's very hard because I'm still mad.
Oh.
It's hard to make it funny.
Oh, yeah. God, it takes years. You have to callus. You have to get a callus totally. Going.
It's like I can make fun of certain things that I feel like I'm not mad anymore about. But like today, for example, I'm writing a packet for a late night show. And I'm like, I'm trying, of course, because I always do when I submit anything, to take a Native point of view and look at a current event through a Native lens. And I'm trying to write jokes. And I'm like, God, I'm still really pissed about that MAGA hat kid. And I can't get past it.
Exactly. Yeah. Hadn't been straw into gold.
Yeah, 100%. And you do it with poetry, which is fucking magical.
Language.
Yes, language is amazing.
Yeah, it's just all about manipulating and crafting language to do what you want, you know? Mm-hmm. Poetry's my bitch.
Yes. What is it like being a Native woman in writing, especially with humor? Do you call yourself a satirist?
I guess, on good days.
Yeah, me too on good days, me too. That's what I am, I'm a satirist.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's kind of what you are good at. Right?
Well, it's something I've worked on for a while, just trying to, write these little points of view, just kind of like, and it's, it isn't as social activism. I mean, it's an act of survivance, right?
Yeah, totally.
We have such horrible, sad stories about ourselves, and I just feel like it's important to be able to look at it from a different point of view and, create more levity and lightness in our perspective and the perspectives that people have about us.
Mm-hmm.
The Stoic Indian.
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
the tear, the crying Indian, and
the Italian man that cries at the garbage.
Mm-hmm. And,
and
humor, of course, it's clowning. It's like a veil for fury. It's a way to deal with those types of situations.
I'm just interested what it's like to be a woman, a female in the industry, in the space that you are in literature, Native lit.
Well, I think no time is better than the present. But, because I started so early, like in the 90s, things were very different than they are today. My gosh, things are very explosive. To me, I think I made a joke or tweeted something a few weeks ago about how, the literary landscape for Native America is like the Wild West.
Yes,
I mean,
totally.
Just like land grab, you know. And it's a terrible, terrible, terrible analogy, of course. but it's, you know, it just really feels like that. There's just like things popping up all over, you know, people getting, you know, deals all over, you know, every other day there's like some new person signing, you know, with either an agent or signing with like, you know, a top five publisher. And I just sit there in awe with my mouth hanging open going, what?
Yeah.
Because, you know, this is not a reality at all, you know, for me 20 years ago. And so, I mean, it's hugely progressive. And I think that it's a good thing, most definitely, and an amazing, you know, amazing thing. And I do hope that it continues. Absolutely. I mean, I hope it's not just some, you know, fluke, you know, the tie or something, this like new, you know, nouveau literary renaissance.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I was in college, like, from 2000 in my early years of college, like I took a native lit course from a white person, of course. But I, you know, even at that time in 2005, it was like, we're in a native literature renaissance, you know, it was like always a renaissance. And I just wonder if it can be, like, is this are we still in a renaissance, or is this just like becoming a lot more mainstream that like, Indigenous people can write things.
Yeah. I know. It's so persistent though, you know, those removing the blind from, you know, American society or even the world as well. Right.
Totally.
And it's just, it's such a heavy rock and people just don't seem to want to, you know, open up their eyes to it. But more and more very progressive-minded, liberal-minded, you know, gatekeepers and publishers are getting a lot more hip and, you know, more woke, as it were.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, being able to, and I, you know, I'm always surprised. I'm just seeing a lot more fluency from, you know, non-native people in the publishing world. Where I'm not having to, you know, explain myself. And, you know, a lot of that is just, you know, social media. And people just are a lot more interested and want to be a lot more inclusive. And so it's an incredibly exciting time, I think.
It is an exciting time.
Sounds like a cliche, you know. Oh, it's so exclusive. You know, that's an exciting time. But, I mean, it's...
Well, with the exciting time also comes a lot of really disparaging acts that happen to our people. So it's both it's exciting in a lot of ways.
But the voices are getting out there, you know.
Yes,
and
totally.
Government, and you know, that was like a huge thing. And it's funny, you know, because this, what is this, 2019? It's like 2020, and my God, you know, like we were so behind.
I know, like that there are still firsts happening.
There's still firsts happening everywhere. Like every other Native person now is like, I'm the first one to ever, you know, and it's like, I'm the first person on the moon. And but it's so true.
I would love to be the first late night writer, Native late night writer. Is there already one? I hope not. Here's to hoping.
I think there's a lot of people that probably identify.
Yes.
You know, but there's always that sort of sketchy, you know, Elizabeth Warren kind of.
Yeah, it's a very, the screenwriting world is riddled with pretendians.
That's like something I'm really interested in hearing a lot more about. I mean,
another episode off the record discussion that you and I can have.
We will
about...
have like much back and forth. This will be very, very interesting. The different worlds, you know, and I want them to collide. I really do.
I think they will.
I'm like really interested in the kinds of work that you're doing, because I'm just like super interested in, you know, how those two places, like literary stuff and then, you know, entertainment stuff, can just like, you know, meld together, because
they
really need to.
There is, you know what? I don't know if I can say that. No, I'm going to say it. There is like a not a necessarily like a overt Me Too situation, mm-hmm. but that is happening in like natives in Hollywood. But there's definitely some gatekeeping happening, and it's always centered around men. And it challenges us to think about, to evaluate, first of all, how small our community is and how dangerous it can be for us as like non-represented, you know, writers to try to speak out about shit. And how hard it is to also kind of cultivate a community of women specifically in this craft, who, so that we can have community, so that we can all agree, like, this is really happening. We see each other, like, it's necessary that there are, like, that we support each other through this, because it could very easily be an issue that's totally drowned out by the larger Me Too movement. But, like, do you see any of that in publishing?
Yeah, there was the Me Too movement that hit publishing and, you know, impacted Native American women writers about a year ago.
Oh, yes.
Made national news. And that really turned things upside down for a little while. It was all that anybody was talking about. It was, you know, really dramatic. And then, you know, just like in all of the Hollywood stories, it sort of spread to different, you know, other writers within the literary framework.
Yeah.
It was very, very dramatic. And I feel like it opened up the playing field, like, you know, ever since, you know, that occurred a year ago. And that's when mm-hmm. I started. That's when it just seemed like things just incredibly flowered, you know.
Interesting.
It was sort of like a new dawn.
Really?
It felt like that. It felt like there was, you know, if there's one writer that's taking up all of this, you know, space and all of this bandwidth, and the go-to and, you know, the token person, then it just doesn't allow for a lot of space for other writers, a lot of, you know,
yes.
and the diversity within
yes.
the, you know, the indigenous publishing and indigenous writing space. My gosh, there's so much diversity just within it. And
totally.
Yeah. And it wasn't being, you know, it wasn't being put out there, really. People weren't supporting all of it. They just wanted the one thing. They just wanted to be able to recognize the one thing. It's just, you know, it's too complicated. Like what we were talking about earlier with him, just as far as, you know, language and terms, mm-hmm. having to do with body and body image mm-hmm. and all of these sorts of terminologies that we're having to make space for now. It's too complicated. You know,
it's too much.
It's just too much to, like, have to keep track of. But, you know, that's the reality of a better tomorrow, right, is the mm-hmm. is complexity and being able to, like, hold two different ideas simultaneously. Oh, my
yep.
God. That hurts.
Multitask. We can do it.
That hurts my head. Ow. I can't see in black and white anymore. You know?
Yep.
So, yeah, I think it, like, really breathes a lot of life through just to be able to have that kind of thing going on. Because it wasn't just about sexual harassment.
And yeah.
It wasn't just about that. It was about, you know, this other situation that's happening, you know, like bullying, you know, and being...
Yeah.
And suppressing other people's voices.
Yeah, for us, I guess it's about bullying and gatekeeping, really. And, mm-hmm. and you know, trying to ostracize certain people from the industry or whatever, mm-hmm. or like, you know, very, very strong bully tactics. And it's kind of like, I don't know, this is like, so the way this is so not our way. Mm-hmm. why?
I mean, a lot of people, you know, would have the opinion that there's just a lot of ugliness kind of underneath, you know, you turn the body over and there's just a lot of see underbelly stuff.
Yes.
That happens. And I think that's true of any industry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I do too. And especially I've been noticing in smaller, mm-hmm. more silenced groups. Mm-hmm. So this is where darkness can flourish. Which is why I think it's so fucking great when I see, for example, your McSweeney's letters. Like, McSweeney's is a huge satirical publication and site, and like, I see a funny Native woman writing a great McSweeney's article, and I'm like, bring some light into this damn room.
But I was not the first.
Damn
there is there's a Navajo writer that was the first McSweeney's. She planted the flag.
She did? Dang. Well, who was it?
Natanya Pulley. She has a book coming out.
Well, good job, Natanya, for being the first.
You're
the first. I honor you, and I hold you on high. I'm going to read a paragraph from your McSweeney's article really quick, because I just think it's so fucking great. I wrote an article about this same topic, but it didn't get published. Not mad about it. but this one is so good. So the title is An Open Letter to White Women Concerning The Handmaid's Tale and America's Cultural Amnesia. So where am I going? First of all, everybody should just find this article. I'll link it to the show notes, and I'll link it in the website so you can just read it. Here's this one paragraph. I'm just going to read the third paragraph. And it says, "But if I may be so bold, do you know what's actually not fictional, Kinsey? The Indian Maiden's Tale. Yes, Indigenous women are well acquainted with that American dystopian nightmare. At the risk of sounding like old broom upper ass Aunt Lydia, an episode from The Indian Maiden's Tale is when Indigenous children were torn from their mothers and confined to residential boarding schools, forced to contend with all manner of horrors and abuse. A hellscape of horrors and abuses, not so very different from those portrayed in your favorite TV programming. So, Waverly, I hope the next time you cozy up with a box of wine and watch another thrilling episode of The Handmaid's Tale, you'll pause and reflect on Indigenous women and children who have endured unconscionable suffering." So poignant!
Not so, so funny, though.
I mean, I think it's hilarious that you just keep shouting out hipstery fucking lady names.
Right.
Yeah, not so very poignant, but also with a hint of a little wink and a smile. That's the kind of comedy I like. Mm-hmm. I like it to be truthful. I like it to be hard hitting. Mm-hmm. And a little bit like sassy. It's got a bite.
Yeah.
I just think it's fucking cool that you have written for McSweeney's, and I don't know why. I mean, I think it's just like in the comedy world, it's like a big badge of honor.
Yeah.
So, a badge to you.
A badge for the badge. I didn't just say that. You can like cut that part out. I don't even know why I said it. Thank you.
I want to close this out on a one cool thing. Every episode I ask my guests to talk about one cool thing that you're really loving right now. It can be a person, an article, a piece of writing, a Twitter or Instagram influencer, anything. Do you have one cool thing that you want to talk about today, Tiffany?
I wanted to boost, a person that I think is really important insofar as food recovery, Indigenous food ways.
Yes.
Since we're talking about bodies.
Yes.
Staying healthy and, you know, eating right. Her name is Devin Mihesua. It's her name. Her last name is spelled Mihesuah. She's a Choctaw scholar. And she basically wrote the Bible on Indigenous food systems. And her work is everywhere. And she has had a tremendous influence on so much of what is current today. And she writes in every genre, and academic and creative. She maintains blogs and websites on Indigenous foods and health. She has like three different blogs and websites, Indigenous food and health website, and a Facebook page, and a blog. And she, you know, she like cooks and eats everything like that's growing on her property, on her land. And it's really, really fucking cool.
That's fucking cool.
Yeah.
Devin Mahesua.
Oh yeah, she's remarkable. She's just an amazing person, and you know, and has just influenced so much, you know, in literature and food ways and systems and all of this kind of stuff. So her books are covering our ancestors' gardens, Indigenous recipes, and guide to diet and fitness. You can find it.
Cool.
Yeah, that's really because that's like a new horizon, and that also is very interesting and exciting right now.
I know, totally. I mean, we could have had a whole thing about that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, food sovereignty is, like, kind of at the crux of... It's one of the things at the crux of Indigenous survivance and Indigenous sovereignty, really. And also, you know, something that we talk a lot about in terms of diet culture and... kind of reclaiming our body identities is recognizing that our food is super colonized and we're just consuming just the white people's food.
Yeah. I mean, in France, they said, you know, let them eat cake or something. Yeah. And ours is like, let them eat fried bread.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
My friend told me a really funny joke. She said that after learning that the USDA was making a lower fat version of commodity cheese, that her friend said, first they took our land, now they want our cheese.
I love it.
Yeah, it's so good.
I love it.
Cracked me up.
Don't fucking take our cheese. You gave it to us. Don't take it back. It's the real Indian givers. Don't you dare take that melty ass cheese. Tiffany, how can people follow your work and support you and buy your literature?
They could just go to the Twitter account. I think that it's my Tiffany Midge is my handle on Twitter. That's like a good place to start. Like I update it a lot. In months to come, I'll probably open up a Facebook page and another Twitter account for a book that's coming out in fall of 2018. Bury My Heart at Chuck E. Cheese's.
Bury My Heart at Chuck E. Cheese's. We're going to need to all buy it in the fall.
It's like a book of, you know, essays. Because I wrote a humor a column for Indian Country Today, and that was terrific. So there's a lot of those essays in that book, in that collection.
Awesome.
It could be really, really fun, and maybe I'll be the first.
I'll be the first.
Native American woman to write a book of humor. And people will just be like, they'll just like, their heads will explode. Like,
mine will. But not before I option it and be the first Native American woman to write a comedic series.
I mean, tears of joy. What's happening? I'm so confused.
Oh my god. Everybody check out Tiffany's work. Get her lit. Buy it. Support her. Shout her out on the Twitters. Tiffany, thank you so much for being on the podcast and for being in my life.
Yes.
Thank you for being in my life.
Yes.
Want to know more about this week's guest? Go to womanofsize.com and you can read extended show notes and links based on this week's topics of conversation. While you're there, sign up for the Woman of Size newsletter and you'll get a monthly email with exclusive written and video content from your girl, Jana. If you're enjoying this podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review in Apple Podcasts and tell a friend. I hope to see you here next week. And until then, be big, baby.
This has been a Hoo Ha Ha podcast.